Rush to Their Seeds as we restart the virtualization session here at Linux Talk 2011. Hope everyone had a nice lunch break, and I'd like to welcome you back for our afternoon session, which is headlined by the keynote given by Wim Cockerts from Oracle. I'm not sure if it's going to be a really cloudy talk that actually gives us a little rest from the sun outside, but I hope it's very interesting for everybody. So here he goes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I hope it's not going to start raining when we walk outside later today. All right, so my name is Wim Cockerts. I'm from Oracle HQ in San Francisco, Redwood Shores. Originally from Belgium, I moved it to the US in 97. At Oracle, I'm responsible for all our Linux work and also all the core virtualization pieces, VirtualBox, Sunray, VDI, Oracle VM. All those products are in my group. One little outlier is MySQL support. That's also in my team after this an acquisition, but basically a large chunk of the more popular open source things that we do at Oracle. Popular in the sense of popularity. In particular. So anyway, so what I figured I'd do today is kind of maybe give a little bit of an overview of you know, cloud computing is this big word that everyone talks about these days, and sort of an idea of what we see in, on the business side more than developers individually, and then specifically around Linux, what we're doing to make Linux work well in that space, and what we hope others will also work on to make Linux work well in the cloud space. It's this next version of sort of a Linux expansion, right? We're going from thousands of systems within a company to tens of thousands of systems because of virtualization. And so there's a lot of stuff that needs to change. It's not about having a new kernel feature in there that makes this work better or worse. It's about a whole ecosystem around building distributions and being able to install applications on top. So that's sort of what I had had in mind. I'm not going to do a product pitch. I'm not in marketing. I'm in development. So don't worry that this is not going to be an Oracle product presentation. So the first one here, this slide, is basically, you know, when you talk about cloud, you first need to define what it is, because everyone has a different opinion on it. Some folks think it will, you know, solve world hunger, but it's not going to do that anytime soon. So, you know, in general, the definition of cloud computing basically is you have this massive pool of resources, memory, disk, CPU and all that stuff. And the goal is that from an internal IT point of view, you can make use of all of that basically transparently. Right? The idea is that you're no longer working on an individual physical server. You say, I need a new machine. You get some VM that pops up somewhere with a set of applications installed, and life goes on. So it works really well, or the intention is to make it work really well for the system administrator. So sysadmin's job is supposed to go down. Makes it a lot easier. They just click on a button. But right now, it doesn't really do anything above the operating system. And so when we look at cloud computing, we look more at the full stack. Right? You're running a big application. You have a gold image of that somewhere in the software library. Somebody says, hey, I need a copy of that. It takes 5 seconds to clone that image. It still takes you a week to configure the whole stack because host name changed, IP address changed, passwords changed. And that's the part that still needs to come in the future. So it's really about, you have a lot of stuff in a big data center, you just make it look like one big pool of things and you can make use of it. The second one is the service model. So there's always talk about those three different kinds of models, software as a service, platform as a service, and IaaS, IT, infrastructure as a service. The bottom one, infrastructure, is the one that's the most widely used right now. That's pretty much where everyone's focused on. Software as a service is sort of a, anyone that builds a website that looks like a product can call themselves as having a software as a service offering, so I'm not really sure how all that matches. And then in the last one, you have sort of the deployment models, Amazon EC2 being the big one, public cloud, private cloud, and then sort of a mixture of those models. I like to call it external cloud and internal cloud rather than public and private. There's not that much public about having your data in EC2. So here's that more detailed description. So software as a service, again, it's about delivering applications, general over the web, so web-based app like Salesforce.com, stuff like that. The OS is totally hidden, right? It can be on any platform, it can be any app server, any database, it doesn't matter. As a user, you have no idea what it is. As a developer, you know, basically put stuff together that displays an application. Platform as a service is relatively new, and a number of companies are starting to play here. Azure from Microsoft and the Google app platform, and the last couple of weeks I heard Red Hat's trying to find its way into that arena as well. So it's basically a different way of developing applications. It also means that people have to change the way they're doing things. It's a new model. It's for new development, for future stuff. It's not so much you can necessarily make use of for an existing environment. So if you have applications that you're running today, that component is not necessarily something you would make use of. Infrastructure as a service really is virtualization, sort of the next generation, right? For the most part, this is still all about, I have a virtual machine software layer somewhere, whether it's VMware or KVM or Hyper-V or, in our case, Oracle VM or whatever, and people install that. It takes over the storage, it takes over the network configuration. You click on a button for a VM, and a VM pops up. So that for the most part, that's still that level. Nobody knows what's running inside the VM. There's no monitoring of the application, but that's really what infrastructure as a service is all about. So this is a little bit of a build slide. If you look at Linux in this world in particular, what has changed is that about 10 years ago, you know, you had relatively big Unix systems, and then the start of the smaller x86 boxes that became more and more popular, two-socket machines that have now grown into, you know, 8-socket Intel boxes are getting more and more popular, 160 threads, 2 terabytes of memory these days. But basically, it was about dedicated physical servers. Linux runs on it. People are happy with it. They're servers. They're easy to install. Applications run native on it. The other part was HPC, and this was one step up. So HPC meant that you wrote applications that were meant to scale out. You could not just take any app, put it in a cluster, and it would scale, right? You had to write apps that would do that way. So that was really the way to do it. You had big machines or you had small machines with dedicated written software that could let you scale out in an HPC form. So those were sort of the two models. Then the next phase was going into virtualization, and that was sort of a different angle. This was big system scale out. That one was going back to smaller virtual machines. So it was, I have a lot of these machines that are used 10%, let's consolidate them 10-to-1 and 5-to-1 and so forth. So the next phase of this whole computing cycle was really to reduce the number of physical systems. You were still running the same applications, but it was just about consolidation. So the next step is, this was well under control, easy management tools. Now people want to do this whole utility computing thing with like a phone company or an electricity company. So you want chargeback. You know, I'm using 5 hours of CPU time. I want to get that charged to my department, something like that. And so cloud computing really has been virtualization with extra management software on top. Right, a lot of companies come out with cloud management products, and it's basically a flash GUI or something like that that just talks to virtualization software, and you get drag and drop instead of clicking a next button or something like that. On top of that, of course, is the public cloud. So EC2 was probably the first one that got into this space, and there. You know, you no longer have access to virtualization management. You have a simple API. You say, here's a gold image, please give me a VM. It runs on somebody else's infrastructure. And so now the idea is to combine the two. Hybrid clouds are something a lot of customers that I talk to want, but it's not really very usable today. The problem is getting your data from your company to that external hosting environment and back. If you have a 5 terabyte database, you're not going to say, oh, let me make a quick backup to EC2. It just doesn't work that way. Where that hybrid model comes into play that's interesting, though, is when you do middleware type things and these enterprise ESB buses where you can connect applications together. So you could say that you host, for instance, database servers within your company, you host the application servers on an external cloud environment, and you just use a SOA layer to talk to each other. So that way you can still have external VMs, internal VMs talk to each other without having to do a lot of backups and very costly stuff. So those are sort of the models. Linux is used in obviously in all of these in all of these spaces, but it needs to change a little bit. Right here, you have a standard operating system you install, you have a few thousand packages that get installed, and we're moving to a model where each VM ends up being sort of a special purpose virtual appliance type model. One application gets one virtual machine. What that also means is that you want to be able to install the OS so that it is really tiny, and that when you clone it, that you can clone it and it does reconfiguration on the fly. And so this is how I kind of see the Linux evolution. So general purpose Linux, of course, is what you get today when you download your favorite distribution. So that needs to evolve because big systems are not going away anytime soon. You know, we have, like I said, 2 terabyte x86 boxes these days. There's a lot of kernel development still needed to make that run really well. Then there's the other angle, which is embedded Linux, so make it as small as possible. You have a custom kernel. You have custom packages and stuff like that, but it's not something that you run on a standard PC. And so this third one is this whole Linux-based appliance model, or just enough operating system juice model that's coming up. And Linux distributions today don't really support that model very well. You can go to an online service and say, create me an appliance, and it'll generate an appliance, but you can't really reuse it. You can't really change the flavor of it inside. So that is something that I think a lot of people need to put a lot more attention in. So the goal that you have a distribution that only has maybe 200-300 packages that everyone can use as a base, that if you restart it, it can take a new hostname, IP address, and password and reconfigure itself and you're done time and time again, doesn't really exist very well today. It's not hard to do on an operating system. It's harder to do when the application stack gets installed as well. And I think that part is where Linux can excel, because it is easy to change. It is easy to do installs that have different set of packages. It's something Microsoft has a hard time with Windows, right? So Windows Server in such an environment is non-trivial. So if you want to do more against Microsoft, I think that's a good place to focus on. So that's going forward will make the OS world a little bit interesting. So based on those things, some of the things that we are doing within our group on the Linux side is, one is work on Linux scalability. So now that we have acquired Sun, you know, we have direct access to large toys, so we can play you know, with huge database running on huge systems and then do optimizations. We just spend about a year and a half doing a lot of optimizations running on a 2 terabyte machine, and I can tell you that there's a lot of work that was needed to scale, right? If you have 10,000 processes all doing I/O across, you know, 160 cores, it's a lot different than running Linux on a laptop. So having access as a development team, having access to large systems, of course, makes it possible to do that type of stuff. So that needs to keep going because systems are getting bigger. Linux does need to focus on these platforms. One thing that I put on here, unrelated to cloud stuff, but all our stuff is open. So a lot of people, when they read Slashdot, say, oh, there's proprietary stuff. There's nothing proprietary about the work we've been doing in the past. So you can get the full change log. Every single commit that we do is publicly available for those that care. The other thing that we have been working on for the last, I think the last 3 years, create a set of packages that make it easy for applications to be installed on top of Linux, so that if you, again, do a first boot, you clone a VM, it comes back up, that the application gets notified, you can set configuration scripts, and it will reconfigure the VM when it comes up. These packages are also freely downloadable, but it's something that has helped us a lot. So we have thousands of applications in the company, and we've been building up a software library based on these scripts. So you have an Oracle eBusiness Suite application on top of Oracle Linux. If you do that manually, it takes you about a week to install. If you do this automatically, you download a VM image, you start it up, it asks 5 things. An hour later, it's fully configured. If you clone it, it asks 5 things, and you're automatically reconfigured. Yeah, why is it so hard to install in the first place? Well, you know, it's a big application. There's more stuff out there that's not easy to install. Anyway, so it makes a big difference. The other things related to virtualization in particular is ButterFS and OCFS too. So ButterFS is slowly maturing. Chris has finally found some time to do his file system checker, so I think we're at the end of doing all the core features that are needed. And it's very useful in a world, in the virtualization world, because it can do snapshots, right? So the idea that you have a root file system that's small, you want to do an update, you take a snapshot, you do the update. If the update fails, you go back to an older snapshot. The Migo guys were looking at using this. I'm not sure if they, in the end, actually implemented it, but they were looking at ButterFS for that reason. The other cool thing is that it supports clones, so copy and write clones. And basically, if you have a VM running on the local file system and you want to clone it, then you only use, you know, it's in 1 megabyte chunks, you only use as much as you need. But they're not dependent on each other. One problem with snapshots today is that the snapshot tends to be within the same object as the virtual machine main disk, so you can't run them independently. With RefLink, you actually get a new inode, you get a totally new file, the copy and write stuff is in the background. So you can create 50 clones, you can start them up all at the same time, they end up being totally independent. We did that work also for OCFS2, so OCFS2 is a cluster file system that's in the kernel. We use it in our own virtualization product, so if you don't have a smart storage array in the back end, you just have dumb disk, then you can put OCFS2 on it. A couple of things that are useful for virtualization here is, one, we support DirectIO for loopback devices. So if you have a VM as a file on disk, then if you do IO to it, we actually do write through instead of sort of a file system call, which is slower. And then the other one is RefLink, of course. So you can basically run a VM on server one, and you have a pool of, say, 32 machines, and you can clone this thing on the fly and run them independently anywhere in the cluster at the same time. Right, so that makes it a lot easier. The third one here is part of, some of these features are still heavily debated. Christopher Helwig doesn't like some of this stuff, but Linus seems to be interested in pushing some of it through. For the most part, virtualization tends to be separate VMs that don't know about each other. The problem with that is if you have, say, a 64 gigabyte machine running 4 VMs of 4 gigabyte, there's still a lot of empty space. The VMs will not be able to make use of it because they just see their 4 gig. So what we've been working on is a feature that allows you to create sort of a cache that you know might disappear at any point in time. And so it's called Zcache now. It has had many names. But the goal is that the hypervisor can show memory to VMs and share that memory across the pool. So if it has 20 gigs free, it can say, hey, all you guys can use 20 gig if you need it. So if you're doing a kernel compile and you only run in 4 gig, well, every disk IO, excuse me, is slow, right? So then you can say, well, the file system cache can start making use of hypervisor memory for as long as it's available. So you get this free memory cache for a period of time. If somebody then starts up VMs, it'll take away some of that memory. So you might say, oh, I'm sharing 20 gig now. 2 minutes later, you only have 10 gig. Well, for that period of time, you had IO and you had a disk cache that was much larger. right? So it's this cooperative use of virtual machines and the kernel that make life a lot easier. If you do it behind the VM's back, like swapping to disk or what VMware tends to do, so you can say, oh, I have a 10 gig machine, the VM sees 10 gigabyte, but within the VMware environment, it's only 4 gigabyte and 6 gig is on disk, you don't know. The hypervisor doesn't know what you're doing inside, it doesn't really know what memory you're making use of, right? So this is a little bit of a more cooperative way to make virtualization better. On the hypervisor side, or virtualization side in general, I guess you can kind of chop that up into three things. True hypervisors. Might start a debate here about true hypervisors, but you know, Xen as an open source product at least is a true hypervisor, kind of like ESX. So you have this layer on the bottom, very thin, and then you run VMs on top of it. The next model is the KVM or virtual box model. So you have Linux running in this case, and it makes use of the VT instructions to create VMs. Seems to be more, I was looking at the agenda, KVM seems to be pretty popular here this week. And then you have containers. Drawback of containers is that it's only one operating system, of course. But it's good to see that Linux containers is slowly getting, getting out there. OpenVZ or LXC, I guess LXC seems to be making a lot of progress. This is very, on the Solaris side actually, this is very popular. A lot of people love containers. And since there's no overhead, because you're basically having separate processes running instead of separate VMs, it's also very, very efficient. So I'm really looking forward to the day that we can have Linux, Linux containers as part of the base environment. Things we're doing on the virtualization side, we actually like Xen. It's a good hypervisor. It does things really well for the workloads that we need for large databases and large VMs. So we're putting a lot of extra effort in that. One thing I wanted to point out is that there has been in the last year or two, there have been some comments on, well, you know, Xen is not in the kernel and so it's going to go away. Everything that Linux needs to work with Xen is in the kernel. 2.6.39 pretty much has all the last bits that were needed to make it work as a DOM0 kernel, so the management control domain. There's one little outstanding piece of code for block devices in kernel. Christopher wants it to be in user space, which, yeah, it's not, man. Anyway, we have agreements and disagreements on that, but all the Xen stuff pretty much that needs to be in Linux is now there finally after a few years. Here also there's no secret secret code. We also put a lot of investment still in VirtualBox, right? So from the Sun acquisition, we got VirtualBox. It's a very popular product. It's very cool. It has a good UI, good management tool. So we definitely continue to put a lot of effort into that for people that are wondering if you would. We use we use VirtualBox for a product for the VDI space, actually. It has good video drivers and good USB drivers for Windowsy type environments, and I didn't attend the SPICE talk. I guess I caught the tail end of it. But you know, one of the things you can do with VirtualBox is you can run multimedia type stuff in a VM, and it will actually work very well over remote distance. So if you play a YouTube video in Firefox on Ubuntu, and you use the VirtualBox RDP server and our desktop, you actually get really smooth multimedia out there. Most of these virtual desktop products are focused on Windows, but we can do Linux or even macOS if you avoid the license as well. Data integrity becomes more and more important. So this is something, what data integrity is the idea that you can take an I/O, you pass a checksum along with the I/O, and it goes all the way down to the disk. And before the disk commits the write to the physical media, it will verify that checksum, right? And so the advantage is that if anything happens along the way, whether it's the, you know, the HCA or the memory or the kernel or whatever it is, we will detect it before it gets written to disk. Right? And so that's pretty cool. It avoids data corruption from happening in the first place. That's really what this feature is about. A lot of folks say, well, we can do checksumming in the file system, why do we care? Well, the problem with checksumming is you find it on read. So if you come back a month later and you read that data and it's corrupt, well, it's too late, it already happened. Right? So this is about preventing bad data. Now, as you go into virtualization, you end up adding more layers to the system. Right? So there's more chance of data corruption for happening. So one of the projects we're working on right now is to take this piece, so we've worked with storage vendors and stuff. Linux already has it in the kernel, so there's full support for that. Martin Peterson shoved that in there maybe 2 years ago, somewhere in the 2620-something time frame. And so now we're pushing that up into the hypervisor as well, so that hopefully in, I don't know, 6 months from now or so, when you run Linux in a virtual machine, you run, say, a database or a file system with support for this, when you do an I/O, it will pass the checksum from the guest kernel to the hypervisor, /hypervisor, all the way down to the disk. If something happens along the way, you get an I/O error back before it's written to disk. So it's actually quite important. And I added this little, it should be 2007, CERN did a study where they did 3,000, you know, they have a lot of systems, so they did writes to data for 5 weeks, and in 5 weeks' time they had 8.7 terabyte of data corrupted, purely transient errors that happened somewhere across the path. Can happen with anyone at any point in time, right? And so this would be prevented from happening with that type of functionality. So Linux already has it, now it just needs to go up into the virtualization layer so that guests can have it. The third part of what's important is open standards. Open source is good and cool, but you also need something where people can implement their own way of a standard. There are three parts that I think are interesting here. The first one is OVF. OVF is a DMTF. Standard, and basically the idea is to have a description to package virtual machines, virtual appliances, or sets of them. So you can say, have a middle tier in a database or whatever you want, and that's one unit. So you can package that into one assembly. The drawback of OVF today is that even though it describes a standard, I can still write my own model of packaging a VM that will not run on anyone else's virtualization product, because it has, they have not been willing or interested in making, in making sure that the packages themselves can run everywhere. So it'll let you package a virtual disk format, but it doesn't say which one it needs to be. It can be a totally proprietary one, it can be, you know, VMDK, RAW, VDI, VHD, anything. So if you have a hypervisor and you have something that says, oh, I can import OVF files, doesn't mean it necessarily works. So there's still a lot of work to be done within the OVF committee or community to make that into a true standard that's usable for everyone. Yeah, right. Yeah, but right. So it makes a point, right? There is a need for this, right? And there is a need to have a standard way of packaging something because things move around different virtualization products. So it's just important that people contribute to it and make sure that, you know, it's not just for one virtualization product. The second one, Cloud API. Well, you could call EC2 a de facto standard cloud API, but it's not a standard one. And so there's a need for something like that as well. It doesn't really matter to the kernel guys, but it does matter for people that want to do virtualization at the higher layer. So there's really a standards body that needs to come up to define something like that. We've submitted part of what came from Sun. Sun had a Sun Cloud API initiative, so we submitted that to the DMTF last year. Part of it was to start generating the need to come together in a standard body. Then there's the one layer above, application and OS configuration. So here, it would be good that we had sort of a consensus on startup scripts, first boot, packaging VMs so that not everyone has to do their own thing. If you're an ISV that wants to build an appliance, you're basically doing exactly the same thing as 50 other ISVs, and there's no simple way to do it today. So it would be good to have a set of packages that whoever helps on to make that happen. Clear out swap space, make sure that the right things are set in the VM so that when you shut it down, you package it, it comes back exactly the same way and it's as small as possible. So we're putting a lot of stuff, a lot of effort into OVF, VirtualBox in particular, but yeah, sometimes things break when you go from V1 to V2 for assemblies. It's still early days, right? It's still sort of a trial and error. We have a product called Assembly Builder, which I have a little picture of later. It's sort of like an assembly line. You have a visual diagram. You can kind of drag and drop different applications onto a screen, and it connects the dots and builds out a full infrastructure of virtual machines that can talk to each other. They're automatically set up that way. And then we're bundling packages like MySQL together into small VMs that, when you start them up, are fully configured. The last thing that we're still actively working on to get some stuff out the door to the, especially the file system folks, is what we call Storage Connect. At the File System Summit last year, we presented a framework to be able to talk to remote storage. So if you have a Linux machine and there's an NetApp filer in the back end, or there's an EMC array in the back end, then you have a standard way of saying, I want to clone this LUN with one API. Vendors can then write a plugin for it, plug it in, and you can talk to any storage. We've been working on that internally for our product, but we also plan to make a Linux version available to us so that anyone that has a Linux box, it's all a bunch of Python stuff, can install this and then you can do remote storage. We've not been able yet to release it at the last File System Summit, but it's coming. This is a model of how we're looking at sort of cloud computing. For us, it's really about the full stack. We're packaging all these applications together. Like I said, you know, some of these things can take a week to configure. In this case, it takes a few minutes or at most a few hours to get going. You do a big download overnight of a big file, but it's all pre-configured, right? And that's really where a lot of the ISVs are going. Instead of saying, here, download this package, install it on your Linux distribution and install these packages, it's just a hassle. So now a lot of ISVs are saying, here is my assembly or my appliance, download it, start it up, and you're done. So more and more of that is happening. A lot of the companies are doing this. I think that's sort of, you know, in the next few years going to be more and more important. Here's that example of the assembly builder. So you can imagine you have all these big applications and you just have a library of little buttons. You tie them together and it just spits out assemblies, goes into a pool, brings them up. You're a developer, you want the same infrastructure, you just click on a button, it goes and finds that template, pulls it out, it configures all these VMs and brings them back up. And this is really where computing is going in a lot of the business world. This is an example of internal Oracle development. We have currently about 11,000, maybe a little bit more than that, VMs. So when a new developer starts and they need a development environment, we have a, you know, you can call it a cloud of a few thousand servers. I think it's about 6,000 physical servers right now. And just push a button, enter the employee ID, and a VM comes back with a P address and a login, and the developer has a full development environment. It saves us a massive amount of time on IT because it used to take a very long time and had very frustrated developers who joined the company and couldn't do anything for a few days before stuff happened. So that whole automation and being able to configure something quickly across the stack is actually saving a lot of money. Right, and maybe not so much at home, right? There's a lot of people in the audience, I'm sure, look at OSs for individual use, and that's great, but there's this whole big world out there of companies that use this in production, use this day to day for thousands of people, and it can save a lot of money, right? It's the wave of the future. So what I would like to see more of is cooperation on standards everywhere. Build tools, even if you like, if you don't like somebody else's tool, implement the same API so that a customer has choice or a user has choice without having to reinstall everything. And small footprint is in again. Smaller is better in the virtual world, right? If everyone installs a 6 gig VM where only 1 gig is needed, that's a lot of waste because memory is not cheap, right? So it's important again to be able to have small applications running. You know, I remember in the early days of Linux, everyone was complaining that Windows was big, right? Oh, Linux can run in 32 megs of memory and Windows needs 512 meg. Well, today if you install GNOME and all that stuff, you need just as much memory. That thing of being small has sort of disappeared. And I think it would be good that, you know, memory is not cheap. So think about that again. On the business side, you know, it's full stack deployment. So again, installing all these components together and making it easy to clone is important, right? So that was sort of my overview of, I guess, what we're doing on the cloud computing side and what we're seeing. It's actually an interesting world. There's still a lot of development needed to make this dream reality. Like I said, it's mostly virtualization today. And Linux is used in almost all of these cases, right? It's a good next step up for putting more and more Linux systems out there in the world. So that's what I had. Are there any remarks or questions that people have? It's a pretty quiet audience. Yeah?
You mentioned your storage access API. Is that backed up by any, like, SNIA standard or something?
No, so the question is on the storage API. This is at a higher level. So the goal is that, you know, for instance, NetApp has a web services API you can call, which is their own. EMC has their own model. And so what we've been working on is define a standard set of calls you would have for storage. So you say, I want a clone operation, I want a create learn operation, I want to, you know, 7 or 8 different of these calls. And then behind that is a plugin that each of these vendors writes so that when I create a virtual machine and I want to learn, I make a call to this API and say, create learn and give me the learn ID back. It then goes and takes that NetApp plugin, talks to the NetApp array, creates a learn, brings back the ID, and then I create it. So it's a little bit higher level.
So you have talked about both VirtualBox and Xen, and then mentioned there that KVM is very popular, so there are a lot of different hypervisors around, and you didn't tell anything about abstraction layers like libvirt.
Libvirt. Yeah.
Or whatever, so some abstraction layer that you can address these different hypervisors in a uniform way.
Yeah, you know, good point. We haven't actually worked with libvirt much on ourselves. But yeah, there is no... I think one of the problems with this is that people have created camps, right? KVM is it, Xen is it, and so forth. And I guess because of that, there's been sort of more or less animosity between the different groups on trying to work together. As far as you can tell, products like Eucalyptus are really the only ones right now that are making a lot of progress into making it possible to talk to multiple hypervisor and hiding that in a layer that's sort of like EC2. Oh, it is EC2. So maybe that's more where this is going, that it ends up being at a sort of a cloud API layer that there's more commonality. Because there you don't care what the hypervisor is. All you care about is saying, you know, give me a VM image. And then it calls out into a plugin. So maybe, you know, the true efforts will be at a layer that's a little higher than libvirt. From what I can tell. fork Xen, why would we fork Xen? Everything we do goes into Xen.org. We take a snapshot of, you know, the time we ship it, and that's it. We don't fork Xen. No different than a distribution forks the kernel when they build a distribution, right? So like I said earlier in the slides, both on the Linux side and the virtualization side, we shove everything we do back into either side, and we take a snapshot. So we'll ship Xen 4, I don't think we're going to 4.1 yet, but 4.0 something in our next release, and that's it. If we end up doing some bug fixes on top of that, they'll go into the Xen.org tree and they go into our product, just like Red Hat Novell or whatever it's called now.
VirtualBox has a dual license model, and the free software community has had some bad experiences recently with Oracle's dual licensing. I just mentioned OpenOffice versus LibreOffice. So, in my point of view, Oracle has forced the community to make a fork. So, can we expect that the same will happen with VirtualBox in the near future?
So, okay, actually. That's a good one. We made VirtualBox more open than it was before. If you go look at VirtualBox version 3, you had a core that was GPL installer and everything around it was non-GPL. So to build a distribution on VirtualBox, you had to build it yourself. If you go to it now, since I think VirtualBox version 4, the entire component is GPL, installer, everything. We have a few separate. You have a USB driver and something else on top of it, like the RDP server on top of it, that's not open. But the entire VirtualBox stack, including installer, bottom to top, is GPL. So we've made it a little bit more open than it was before. Right? We love VirtualBox, we're not making it less open, we've made it more open than it was before. You can now take it in Debian and have the installer and the entire GUI stuff built in under GPL. Since last December, October, November, December. Anyone else? I'm not answering open office questions. Sorry? For the most part, open standards means that you need to know what you're getting yourself into, right? One problem you have today is there are many standards where companies investing in it have IP and are not willing to disclose that they have IP so that when you implement the standard, you get screwed afterwards, right? So the main thing as a company that we've always pushed for is to make sure that if companies are participating in standards bodies, that they disclose the IP up front so that you can decide to implement it knowing that you might have to pay royalties or decide not to, but that there's at least visibility. So that's one area, right? The other one is the advantage of open standards as a company to implement it is that you show that you're open and there's an alternative. Even if there is no good alternative, from a customer point of view, it feels like there is a choice. So it's actually, we've always seen it as in our best interest to implement things that are open, because then we compete on the features that we have in general. So open standards mean if you implement it, you can use it in your own products, you don't have to worry about getting sued. And it also means that if there are issues, that you're aware of it up front.
More technical question. Do you have any plans for VirtualBox to upstream the kernel accelerator or use KVM as a kernel accelerator for VirtualBox?
To use what? Sorry, the first part I didn't get.
You have this proprietary kernel accelerator and there's KVM. Do you have plans to either upstream your proprietary one or use KVM for that?
We have proprietary what? I just didn't get it.
You have a proprietary kernel accelerator for VirtualBox? Kernel accelerator, where you use virtualization extensions from the hardware?
They're open. Right. Yeah, the only thing that's proprietary, the video side is not open.
Do you have plans to upstream those?
You know, I was thinking about that just yesterday when I arrived here. We never really thought about it. I was going to ask the VirtualBox team, in fact, why they never pushed it upstream. I don't see why we wouldn't. It just never really came up. But it's something I'll get back to when I get back home and talk to them. I just never really thought about it. And I need to get the VirtualBox people's feedback. But yeah, why not? There's a lot of cool stuff in VirtualBox that KVM doesn't yet do. So
yeah, the alternative would be to use the KVM kernel modules.
Yeah, sure. Right now, you know, the VBox guys are doing their thing. But it's something we should discuss. I don't disagree. I'll do that when I get home.
I have a question. VirtualBox has the extension packs. They are not free right now. Will there be?
I don't think so.
Why
not? There's no current plan. There's some IP in there that we would like to keep. So the okay. RDP server, and there's some things in there we would like to keep right now.
Another one, the 3D part. What's the 3D graphics?
The team has been very busy doing other things right now, but 3D is coming back because for our VDI product, we want to do more 3D. And so there will be another focus on 3D implementations with VirtualBox, hopefully in the next 6 months. But that's coming back. It's definitely something we should support and improve on. Yeah. Lance?
Sorry about that. I was just wanted to make a comment about the question before about using KVM modules instead of the VirtualBox ones. VirtualBox supports more than just Linux as the host system, so that might be a technical problem for.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's a fair point.
Well, KVM supported you three PC and Windows as well, which is
irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone else?
Sorry, just an add-on to your answer to my last question. So I appreciate that Oracle has freed more parts of VirtualBox, but the problematic part of the Open Office story was also that the community didn't accept Oracle's, and also partly Sun's before that policy, that you have to transfer the copyright and so on. And so there was a problem with the participation of Oracle and the community. And what is the situation with VirtualBox? Is it comparable to the Open Office situation, or is it different?
You mean a contribution agreement?
Yes, and part of the community doesn't want to transfer their rights, and including the dual licensing and so on, to Oracle. And some contributors really contributed good code, but this wasn't taken into Open Office because of these agreements.
Yeah, well, I think Open Office had more history to it than others. You know, I don't think there's many people even doing VirtualBox work, and I doubt that's because of the agreements. It's a one-way, it's pretty much a one-way street right now. We build the product, add stuff to it, people take it and use it. I haven't seen much contributions coming back. I don't think it's the same as OpenOffice. The team definitely is open to contributions. If that ever were to be an issue, happy to talk to you about it. But right now I don't see that as being a problem. If you think it is a problem, let me know, give me an example, but I haven't seen that be a problem yet.
Yeah. I don't know, I just wanted to ask.
Okay. Yeah.
So, anyone else? I think we are running a little out of time, is that true?
Oh, almost, yeah. Another 5 minutes.
So we have time for one more question, probably. Well,
okay.
No. Okay. Right. Anyway.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wim.
Sure. Right. Thanks.